Every year, the UW-Madison chooses one book for Go Big Read, a university and citywide celebration of reading. And this year's Go Big Read is Ruth Ozeki's luminous new novel, A Tale for the Time Being. Right now, that novel may have more readers in Wisconsin than anywhere else. The chancellor handed out free copies at convocation. More than 50 UW professors are teaching it in their classes. 1,000 people have checked it out of the UW-Madison libraries. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Ruth Ozeki will be in Madison next week to unleash the Go Big Read festivities, and she joins us here this morning to talk about her work and her creative process. And later in the hour, Irish musician Danny Ellis came through Wisconsin this week. His new memoir and his CD, 800 Voices, have gotten a lot of praise from people like Bonnie Raitt. He stopped by the studio to talk and play a song or two, and we'll hear that conversation later. But first, Ruth Ozeki and A Tale for the Time Being, which begins like this.
Hi, my name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you.
Ruth, this character Now has such a vibrant, distinctive voice when she really kind of jumps off the page from the very beginning. How did she come to be?
You know, At the time, I guess it was probably 2004, 2005, I was studying the fascicles, the essays of a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji. And he'd written an essay called, in Japanese it's called Uji, which can be translated as time being or being time or for the time being. But for some reason, every time I was reading this essay, I kept reading time being as in like time being, like human being, right? And this you know, sort of intonation or this phrase just kind of stayed in my mind and somehow just translated itself into the voice of this 16-year-old Japanese schoolgirl, Nao Yasutani. And she just kind of announced herself one day. You know, it was late in 2006, and suddenly these words just came to me, you know, hi, my name is Nao, and I'm a time being.
Well, that's interesting because the narrator in your novel stumbles on Nao's voice herself in the form of Nao's diary, which she stumbles on kind of by accident. And probably not an accident that the narrator, Ruth, that's your name. And in fact, her husband's name is the same as your husband's name.
That's right, right. The character and I share a husband. I know that sounds a little, you know, a little kinky, but, you know.
Yeah. So tell us about Nao. How would you describe her to someone who hasn't met her?
Well, I guess I would describe her as a displaced. She is a Japanese girl born in Japan, but was raised in Silicon Valley in Sunnyvale, California. And the family was forced to move back to Tokyo, where she was put into a junior high school and, you know, had none of the cultural fluency. You know, she didn't have money for nice stuff, and she just didn't really know how to relate to the other kids. And so she is being very badly bullied. And she decides that she's going to kill herself. But before she does, she wants to do one last act of redemption, which is to tell the fascinating life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, who is a Zen Buddhist nun. So in a way, you know, you could say that, you know, she's writing this diary in a way in order to save her life. It's sort of like a Scheherazade kind of story where as long as she continues to write, she'll be okay.
Now, you wrote this book partly in response, I think, to the 2011 Japanese tsunami. It's after the tsunami that Nao's story literally washes up on the shore. Did those events have a big impact on you?
They certainly did have a big impact on me. You know, I had been writing this book since 2006, 2007, and was about to turn it into my editor when the earthquake and tsunami happened. And, you know, it was just a devastating time. You know, I have friends and family in Japan, and of course I was worried about them. Some of my friends lived in the Sendai area. And, you know, I spent weeks and really months after that just watching the video footage, you know, the cell phone footage and, you know, all of those images of the tsunami just, you know, washing away entire swaths of the Japanese coastline. You know, it was a horrible event, and it really raised some questions for me. You know, how, as a fiction writer, do I respond, you know, using the tools of fiction to an event that is this real, you know? I knew that the repercussions of the earthquake and tsunami were going to be ongoing. The meltdown at Fukushima is, you know, we're only just beginning to understand, you know, how that's going to play out in time.
Right.
And I realized that, well, actually, it was my husband Oliver who suggested that, you know, the perhaps a way I could do this was to break the fictional container and to really step in as a character, you know, as a fictionalized character myself. And that would give me a voice, you know, in which to respond more directly to these kinds of events. And, you know, so I said to him, you know, I said, Oliver, you know, it's a great idea, but you do understand, don't you, that, you know, if I'm in the book, then you have to be in the book, too. and he said he thought it was fine. He didn't mind. And he said he thought it would be an interesting thought experiment. Mm-hmm. So that happened. Yeah.
And this must also have been, this is a very personal theme for you. You're half American, half Japanese, grew up in this country. At what age did you first go to Japan?
Well, I first went to Japan when I was 7 to visit my Japanese grandparents, and I, you know, I remember it was a wonderful trip and just so strange and mysterious and baffling to me, and you know, I was always fascinated with the Japanese side of my heritage. You know, I've always gone back and forth between the two countries, and in one sense, I'm neither here nor there, but somehow, in order to be who I am, I need to kind of be straddling the two, you know, mm-hmm. the two cultures.
There are so many characters in the book that we can't possibly talk about all of them, but one of the most important to now is her grandmother, who is a 104-year-old Buddhist nun. Is she modeled on anyone in particular?
Yeah, she's actually, yeah, she's the great-grandmother.
Great-grandmother.
And she's, yeah, I can recognize a little bit of my mother and my grandmother in her. I can also recognize, I drew inspiration from a real-life Buddhist, Japanese Buddhist nun who is not 104. She's much younger. She's only 90. But she is. She was a novelist. Her name is Setouchi Jakucho. And she was a novelist and a very interesting woman. She led a very risque youth and had lots of love affairs. And when she was she wrote about her love affairs in great detail. And she became famous for writing about sex from a woman's point of view, for which she was, you know, quickly labeled a pornographer by the, you know, mainstream male literati in Japan at the time.
Have you ever met her?
I've not met her. I would really, really like to meet her. I've read her books, and she's still a very powerful activist, and she's writing. And when Japan was going to open up the nuclear reactors after Fukushima, she was out there on the front lines in her wheelchair doing a hunger strike in protest. So she's really a wonderful, wonderful woman.
Yeah. Now, you are also yourself a Zen Buddhist priest. I think you were ordained in 2010.
That's right.
Yeah. Are there elements of Zen Buddhist philosophy that you wanted to explore or embed in this novel, particular elements?
Well, I think that more than that, it's kind of the other way around. It's a chicken and the egg situation. It was more that in the years prior to writing this novel, I was practicing Zen Buddhism very seriously. And I was doing a lot of meditating and a lot of study of Zen philosophy. And I think the book really grew out of that. It wasn't so much that I wanted to, you know, embed Zen philosophy in the book, but it was more
the
that
novel
the book
embedded itself in your practice.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And in a way, the novel is an expression of that practice. The novel is almost a response to the kind of philosophy that I was reading at the time.
In what way?
Well, there's certain, you know, I guess the way I like to think about it is, in a sense, you know, the book is a performance of certain Zen philosophies, certain Zen propositions. For example, you know, Zen teachings on time and impermanence, or Zen teachings on interconnectedness, what is called in Buddhism dependent co-arising, the way that we are never separate from each other. You know, there's no separation between self and other. And I think that all of these, you know, these kinds of philosophical propositions, if you read the book with those in mind, you can see how the book kind of enacts those.
Speaking of the interconnectedness, for instance, that sort of explains why the boundaries between now and your narrator at times kind of get a little blurry. They move in and out of each other's lives in a way.
Yes, they certainly do. They certainly do. You know, that's one of the things that's always fascinated me as a writer, too, is the way that we do kind of blur with our characters. You know, where do these characters come from? I mean, it's a mystery to me. I don't really know, even though they do come to me and I write them down and then they become very real for me. And then I, you know, put them out into the world and then they become very real to other people as well.
But you're suggesting, aren't you, also that our notion of self or of having an independent self in the real world is something of a myth, an illusion.
It is an illusion. Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, there's no way to be an independent self, is there? How could you possibly be an independent self? I mean, we come from somewhere. We come from our mothers and our fathers. You know, we can't survive. We can't survive for a minute without others around us. We're just an extension of, you know, the world in which we live. And in Buddhism, it's often looked at as, you know, we're like waves in the ocean. We rise up from the ocean and appear very briefly as a little white, you know, speck, piece of foam in the water, but then we subside again into the larger ocean. And we're time beings in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we rise out of time and then we fall back into time.
Or I was going to say, another way of putting it is we're all ghosts.
Yes, we're all ghosts, exactly.
Yeah, there are some real ghosts in this book. Also, now meets the ghost of what a uncle does.
Haruki, yes, that's right. Her great uncle, Haruki number one. That's right.
So I'm curious. Western culture, of course, has this long history of ghost lore and ghost stories, but the notion of ghosts in Japanese culture, and especially in Zen Buddhist culture, I think, is somewhat different.
It is different. And, you know, I've never really done that extensive a study of Western ghosts. But Japanese ghosts are so numerous, you know, they're interesting and strange and shape-shifting and magical. And they've got all sorts of strange powers. And you know, it's a fascinating study of Japanese ghosts.
Well, I was thinking more of the sense in which the ancestors are very present.
Yes,
for many people in daily life.
That's right. I mean, my grandmother, for example, always kept a small shrine, a small altar in her house, no matter where she went. And every day she would wake up in the morning and she would boil hot water for tea. And she would bring a cup of hot water to the altar and give it to my grandfather, who had been dead for many years. But this was her ritual. And in a sense, it kept him there. It kept him, you know, alive and present in her life. And so this was something that in Japanese culture, the ancestors are never, never far away. They live, you know, just on the other side, and they visit frequently. I mean, certainly once a year, there's a wonderful festival called Obon, which appears in the book as well. But it's a bit like the Mexican Day of the Dead, where the ancestors come back to visit the living.
Hmm. I read an interview with you recently in which you referred to a Japanese word or concept, kotodama, which means something like the spirit in words. I guess I don't know much about the concept, but it made me wonder, can words sort of have ghosts?
Well, I think they are ghosts. Words are ghosts. Language is a ghostly kind of ritual that we perform. We've inherited language from the dead, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every time we speak words, we are actually speaking the language of the dead, the tongues of the dead. So, you know, in that sense, I think language is ghostly.
That's very lovely. That makes me wonder whether writing is a form of Zen practice for you, or vice versa, or I guess how the two inform each other.
The two are very, very close, to the point where I would almost say at this point they are they're not the same, but they are expressions of each other. How's that? You know, I've been meditating for many years, and I find that the relationship between the two practices really is very intimate and mutually supportive. You know, they're both contemplative practices. They both require a kind of a tuning in to the mind in a particular kind of way. They're wonderfully supportive of each other.
And circling back to that theme of time, they both seem to me to be practices that are part of an effort to change our relationship to time or change our perception of time.
That's a wonderful thought, because I think, you know, one of the things that meditation teaches you, you could actually say that meditation is a way of practicing patience. It's a way of learning to wait for nothing. And and this is very, very useful for a novel writer. You know, as Now points out in the book, you know, it's very difficult to keep up with the mind. You know, as a writer, it's very difficult to kind of keep up with the mind. And you always feel like you're just lagging behind slightly. But I think that once something has been written, then we can look at that and we can think, yes, that is an expression of a moment in time. And so in a way, a book is a time capsule. And, you know, it reminds me, too, of the ancient Greeks used to believe that when you recited the poems of a dead poet, it was actually the dead poet who was borrowing your tongue in order to make himself or herself understood.
I have to say, reading the book, it took me a while to realize that you named one of your main characters Now. It's almost as though you've embedded a Zen cone at the center of your book.
That's right. Well, it comes from the Japanese word, you know, the Japanese name, Naoko. So it's N-A-O-K-O.
Sure, but you've made a cross-cultural joke.
Absolutely. So much of the book is, it's about the relationship between a writer, this young girl, the 16-year-old girl, and her reader, the frustrated novelist named Ruth. And there's a lot of play.
Oh, sure. And it's filled with, I mean, there are times when reading the book feels like wandering through a museum of, you know, wonderful shards and fragments of culture, things that you put in the book just because they fascinated you so much.
Well, I certainly think the ghosts, the Japanese ghosts, I've always been in love with Japanese ghosts. There were parts of Japanese history that have always been fascinating to me. In 2001, I think it was, I read a book written by a University of Wisconsin anthropology professor, Emiko Okuni-Tierney. She wrote a book called Kamikaze, Nationalisms, and Cherry Blossoms. And I was just fascinated by it. It's an analysis of the diaries and letters and writings of young students and young men who were conscripted into the Japanese army during World War II and were forced to become kamikaze pilots. And they were some of the, you know, the best and the brightest of, you know, the young Japanese students at the time. Very articulate. They read, you know, multiple European languages, proficient in European philosophy, and could write about the ethical and moral dilemmas that they were facing in just absolutely heartbreaking ways. You know, as somebody who grew up, as, you know, I was a child in the post-World War II years. You know, I was born in 1956, which was only 11 years after the war had ended. And so I grew up, with very, very strong anti-Japanese propagandistic images still that were very much a part of the culture, you know, during my childhood. So to read these incredibly articulate, heartbreaking letters and diaries by these young kamikaze fighters, you know, it sort of opened my eyes too to the horrors of that war and the horrors of, you know, military conscription. And so that was something that I had really wanted to write about. I wanted to include a character like this in a work, but I, you know, until A Tale for the Time Being, I hadn't quite found a way.
Well, this would be a great way to ask you to, for one more reading as we close. There's a moment when, a scene when Now meets the ghost of her long-dead uncle who was a kamikaze pilot. Would you read that scene for us?
Okay. So in this scene, Nao is visiting her great-grandmother at her Zen temple on the mountainside. And at night, she's been visited by the ghost of her great-uncle, Haruki Number One. And her uncle wasn't terribly conversational, and she didn't really have much to say to him. And so, and she was taken by surprise, so she sings a song to him, Le Mal de Vivre, a French chanson. And in this scene, she's chastising herself. Stupid Nao, what a foolish girl. There I was sitting with the ghost of my dead great-uncle, who just happened to be a kamikaze fighter pilot in World War II, and who was probably the most fascinating person I will ever get to meet. And what did I do? Sing some stupid French chanson to him? How idiotic is that? He must have thought I was just another typical dumb teenager, and his time on Earth was precious, so why waste even a moment of it with me? Better to just shimmer off and hang out with someone who could think of more interesting conversational topics. What is wrong with me? I could have asked him about all sorts of things. I could have asked him about his interests and his hobbies. I could have asked him if only depressed people cared about philosophy and if reading philosophy books ever helped. I could have asked him about what it felt like to be ripped from his happy life and forced to become a suicide bomber, and if the other guys in his unit picked on him because he wrote French poetry. I could have asked him how he felt when he woke up on the morning of his mission, which was also his last morning on Earth. Did he have a big cold fish dying in the hollow of his stomach? Or was he filled with a luminous calm that emanated from him so that everyone around him stood back in awe, knowing that he was ready to take to the sky? I could have asked him what it felt like to die. Stupid. Baka Nao Yasutani.
That's lovely. Ruth, you'll be in Wisconsin soon for the Go Big Read event, which is really sort of an unusual thing. I mean, the chancellor recently handed out complimentary copies to hundreds of undergrads at convocation. Your book's being taught in 50 different courses. I think more than 1,000 people have checked it out of the Madison Public Libraries. I don't want to intimidate you, but I'm curious about how a writer approaches having that kind of very large public conversation about a book.
Well, I just, you know, I can't think of anything more wonderful. I find it very, very moving. And in fact, even just talking about it now, I feel myself getting quite choked up. One thing I should mention, too, is that Madison, Wisconsin is a very important place in my own family history. My father graduated from the University of Wisconsin. In fact, he was born in Stevens Point. So this is, in so many ways, it's a huge honor. And I really look forward to, you know, to visiting campus and to talking with as many people as I can. And yes, carrying on this conversation, having this conversation with both the university and the community.
Well, we can't wait to welcome you back home.
Thank you so much.
Ruth Ozeki is a writer, filmmaker, and Buddhist priest. Her new novel, A Tale for the Time Being, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and it's this year's selection for the UW-Madison's Go Big Read. She'll be in Madison early next week for a public lecture, and we'll post details on our Facebook page. That's 45 North on WPR. Don't forget to friend us while you're there. Next, Irish musician and writer Danny Ellis joins us to talk and sing about growing up in an 800-bed Irish orphanage. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.